Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Sally Santangelo. She's the executive director of CNY Fair Housing, a nonprofit organization focused on housing discrimination in Central New York. She's also the co-chair of the Advocacy Committee of the Human Services Leadership Council of Central New York, and she serves on a number of nonprofit boards. Sally, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let me start by asking you to give us a brief overview of the nature of your organization and its mission and its practices. Just tell us what you folks do and why.
Sure. So CNY Fair Housing, we investigate housing discrimination. We do a lot of education and outreach to teach people about fair housing rights, as well as teach housing providers about what their fair housing responsibilities are. We conduct research and policy work to try to help promote open communities, help build more inclusive neighborhoods, and give people more access to housing choices. And we also have an attorney on staff who provides legal representation to victims of discrimination. And we serve 8 counties of central and northern New York, going all the way up to St. Lawrence County.
And so where does your funding come from?
So we have a mix of funding. The largest source of funding is through HUD, through the Department of Housing and Urban Development, through a Fair Housing Initiatives Program grant. And we also receive funding from the municipalities we serve. So we have funding mostly through community development block grant programs, for example, from the city of Syracuse and Onondaga County, Utica, Auburn, Watertown. Many of the communities we serve, we help provide fair housing services for the people in those communities on behalf of those municipalities.
And do you also raise money from individual donors?
Absolutely. Of course, we do raise money from individual donors. We do some contract work as well.
Okay.
So we do trainings for housing providers. For example, we might train an entire staff of a management company, for example, as well.
And what are your organization's enforcement powers? I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of where you are in terms of relationship to a government organization. Can you actually enforce some of these things?
So what we do is we investigate complaints. So if an individual believes they are a victim of discrimination, they can contact us and we will investigate their complaint. We also conduct undercover testing on behalf of those individuals to try to verify that what they experienced was in fact discrimination. And we also can do, we do audit, what we call audit-based testing, where we go out into the market, into the areas where we suspect there is discrimination, and we are able to do testing and identify areas in which there may be discrimination. And then we do have an attorney on staff who will represent clients. Either we file cases in state or federal court, or we can file cases with New York State Division of Human Rights or with HUD, and is another mechanism, and it's called an administrative enforcement, and we help file those cases on behalf of those individuals, and then we represent them through the legal process, which sometimes can be very long. We also sometimes will just refer individuals to those agencies to file complaints on their own.
And is there a criminal component to some of the enforcement to this? In other words, because what you're describing to me sounds like civil cases, are there ever instances in where the criminal justice system gets involved and actually brings someone, makes a charge against someone?
There could potentially be some criminal elements related to the cases we do. What we do is bring civil cases, but sometimes a case may border on criminal activities. For example, something could be fair housing harassment, for example, under fair housing laws, that may also be a hate crime, or sexual harassment. Sometimes we look at sexual harassment cases that could border on sexual assault. So there sometimes is some criminal aspects to the cases that we're investigating, but our focus is really on civil processes.
I want to come back to some of those different kinds of problems that you just mentioned, but let me ask you another sort of general overview kind of question, and this is the 50-year anniversary of the passage of the Fair Housing Act. So could you provide a thumbnail sketch of the biggest issues in housing discrimination in the 50 years since that passage of that act, both across the nation but also in Central New York in particular? What have been some of the big trends we've seen?
So the Fair Housing Act, when it was passed in 1968, banned discrimination based on race, color, national origin, and religion. It was amended in 1974 to add gender. And then probably the most important amendment to the Fair Housing Act was in 1988, the Fair Housing Amendments Act, which added familial status, so discrimination against families with children, and disability. Since the addition of that, disability has become by far the number one reason for complaints of housing discrimination. In our agency, it's over 60% of our complaints annually are disability-related, and that's a trend both locally and nationally. And that's really been an important area that we're seeing, starting to see, I think, hopefully some progress, but there's still a lot of work to do in terms of making sure people with disabilities have access to housing to make sure that they're able to remain in their housing.
Yeah, I want to come back to that one in particular as well, but here's another sort of context question. The city of Syracuse has been identified, and in your organization, I think, is one of the folks that have helped us see this better, but it's been identified as having particularly concentrated poverty and also racially concentrated poverty. So how does housing segregation in that sense and then housing discrimination work together? Are they related? How are they different? How's that dynamic go?
So certainly they're related. There's ways in which housing discrimination keeps people out of housing, whether it's discrimination in the private market. For example, a housing provider who maybe has different application processes or provides different information to people based on their race that keeps people out of housing that they would otherwise qualify for and otherwise choose. But there's also these really larger systemic issues. Things like where affordable housing is cited that really affect things more structurally and more systemically that we still have a lot of work to do. And many of the reasons why the city of Syracuse continues to have these kind of inglorious distinctions is because of some of these systemic problems that we still haven't addressed adequately.
I love that phrase, inglorious distinctions. I'm going to remember that. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Sally Santangelo, Executive Director of CNY Fair Housing. Now, you mentioned this just earlier, but your office is concerned with not just economic kinds of discrimination, but you're also concerned with other dimensions. You mentioned sexual harassment, I believe, but you also certainly mentioned disability as your single biggest category. So tell me more about how those issues play out in the Syracuse area. What are the dynamics there? What are the problems that you're seeing more specifically?
Sure. So to give you some examples of actually some of the cases we have pending, we have a case, several cases actually, of people with developmental disabilities who are either denied housing or they're treated differently, and it's made clear when they're applying for that housing that they're maybe not welcome there. So we have a case pending where an individual with a developmental disability, the allegations include that the housing provider wanted to interview the person's doctor to see if they could live independently, and then told the individual that they would have to pay a year of rent in advance in order to live in that apartment. So this is just one example, and we have several cases where that are similar patterns. The other big area we focus on in disability is related to reasonable accommodations and modifications for people with disabilities. So a modification would be something like installing a ramp for somebody with a mobility impairment. The accommodations are changes in rules and policies to allow a person with a disability to have the full use of their housing. We have, again, a lot of these cases are related to emotional support animals. We have cases, for example, we have a veteran we're representing who has PTSD and has a dog as an emotional support animal, and our housing provider is trying to evict him because of that dog. And he has a...
violating, like, the no-pet policy, for example?
And violating the no-pet policy.
Okay.
And it's a disability-related need to have the dog. We have... we're seeing more cases for children with autism who have needs related to their disability that housing providers are denying. So one example, it's pretty egregious and sad case, we are representing a family who has a child who has what's called elopement disorder, and the child runs away. Frequently, the parents have to constantly be there within a couple inches of the child to keep the child from running away. And the family is trying to install a fence at their own expense, a fence around the property at the mobile home park. And the mobile home park is been resistant to allowing them to build that fence that is really essential for their child's safety to keep the child from running out into traffic. You know, it happens, the disability discrimination happens both before people apply for housing, but also once they're in that housing as well.
And what about the sexual harassment piece? Tell me about the kinds of things you're seeing there and the nature of that problem.
Sure. So this last year in 2017, we filed a rather large case against a housing provider in the city of Oswego. Eight women are included in that case, alleging that the housing provider was, I hate to use the word offering, requiring sex in exchange for rent or security deposits. And the allegations include unwanted sexual contact. Mm-hmm. And the women who have faced this have, essentially faced a choice. Some of them become a choice between becoming homeless or going along with this housing provider's demands or wishes. And we're starting to look, since we filed that case, we filed that in August last year, we're starting to hear of other cases as well right here, and even some in Syracuse, of housing providers and, doing similar things or just making unwelcome comments. There's nowhere a woman should feel safer than in their own home. We take these allegations seriously. And, I think as part of the national movement to address sexual harassment and deal with sexual harassment, mostly in the workplace, I think women are, starting to come forward, which is great. So we hope to continue to, we want to stop this practice, obviously. And so we hope to continue to push on this effort.
On that last point, I'm curious to know, have you seen an uptick in the number of complaints that you think might be related to the Me Too movement?
I think we are seeing an uptick. And, with the case that we filed in Oswego, once the word got out, about that case, we saw a flood of additional women who came forward and called our office, reached out to us in different ways. With similar allegations against the same housing provider. And I think the women were, it happened to coincide, with this, but I think women are, feeling empowered to pursue their rights and their right to live free of sexual harassment.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Sally Santangelo, Executive Director of CNY Fair Housing, and we've been talking about housing discrimination and housing segregation. You were talking about some categories of some pretty troubling things that happen to people in terms of sexual harassment, in terms of disability discrimination. What's the very worst case that you've dealt with in your time at this agency, the one that really sticks out in your mind? And then I want to also ask a more optimistic question, which is, what do you regard as the best success story, the one you feel the best about?
So I think, certainly the sexual harassment case has been really among the worst that we have ever heard. In a way, sometimes it's the cases that are less obvious and that are really upsetting. The cases where an individual maybe wouldn't have known that they were actually discriminated against, were it not for further investigation. In a way, those almost hurt a little more because we know it's happening and we know it's happening to others. It's estimated nationally 90% of fair housing cases go unreported. So that in a way can be, really maddening. So we actually investigated a property company about a year and a half ago, and we did some of our undercover testing for this property. And it was the way that discrimination has become subtle can be really disconcerting. In this case, we had an African American tester who went to this property to inquire about renting an apartment, and the individual was asked about their job history, and then was told they would need to provide copies of their pay stubs and 3 months worth of pay stubs and a copy of their license to do a criminal and credit check, which is a pretty normal process and something that's not unexpected. We then had a white tester, very similarly matched to the black tester, who then went to the same property, and the white tester was asked about their job history, and that was it. They were not told they would need to provide pay stubs. They were not told that they would need to go through a criminal and credit check. And were it not for those two different experiences, only one, if both of those individuals had a criminal history or had poor credit, only one of them would have been denied housing because of it. Mm-hmm. And we see this repeated over and over again. In that particular case, we actually tested it 5 more times and found similar patterns throughout that with different information that was provided, different ways in which the individuals were treated. And I think that sometimes kind of hurts a little more because we know that that's happening over and over again, and we need to do everything we can to stop it and to teach housing providers that not only is that wrong, but that it will be enforced.
What's the good success story? What's the thing that you look back on and say, oh, that's where we made a difference?
I think we can be really, we've been really successful in some specific instances of just keeping people in their housing. Individuals who maybe were facing eviction and we were able to help keep them in their housing. We had a case a couple years ago of a family who was denied housing. They had, it was a single mother with 4 children, and she was denied housing because of the children, and they wouldn't allow her to rent an apartment. And she ultimately didn't get the opportunity to live in that apartment. They rented it to someone else. But we were able to get her some relief in filing a case, and she was able to, utilize the damages in that to help get, better housing for her and her kids. So sometimes there are successes. Unfortunately, we're at a point right now where the process in pursuing these cases is really long. Pursuing cases with HUD or with the Division of Human Rights is taking upwards of 2 years. So we have right now over 20 legal cases pending that normally should be much shorter. So we're hoping for a lot of good successes in the coming months as we get some of these additional cases resolved.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Sally Santangelo, Executive Director of CNY Fair Housing. I wanted to ask you a couple questions about a different kind of topic, and it's about how this stuff plays out in areas outside the city. And in particular, I want to pose this question to you. It is my impression and my experience that in the better-off suburbs around the city, there is often resistance to new proposed housing projects that include mixed-income housing. The local residents often mobilize to keep those projects from being approved, and they do that for a variety of reasons that don't always get, I think, publicly articulated. What's your take on that dynamic? Is that a problem? Do you see it? And how do you think that the decision-making process around that might be improved if what I'm identifying is correct? Maybe what I'm identifying, I'm not identifying it correctly.
No, it is. You are identifying it correctly. We certainly see this. There's oftentimes proposals to build, for example, not only mixed-income housing, which might include both affordable housing and market-rate housing, but we even see resistance to building luxury apartments in some neighborhoods. And what we see are, sometimes there's resistance to things like traffic or what the building might look like. But time and time again, what we see in often public comments of individuals, neighbors, even in publicly, we see comments like in one instance in a property that's current a project that's currently pending. We see a neighbor who says that they don't want to deal with those people with those problems, or say things like they don't want to live near the riffraff. And this is for a luxury apartment property. We see how
everything's relative, I guess.
Yes. Yes, everything is relative. You know, we see suspicions of, you know, really unfounded suspicions that crime will increase or that the schools can't handle it. And we see really that kind of NIMBYism playing out throughout our suburban communities. I mean, we see it, we've seen it in almost every area. And, you know, and repeat it over and over again. And, you know, we want to make sure people have a lot of different choices in their housing. And, you know, right now, for example, 75% of the affordable rental housing in Onondaga County, 75% is within the city of Syracuse. The city actually only has 1/3 of the housing units, total housing units in Onondaga County, but 75% of the affordable housing.
And of course, that adds to the segregation that, that Brookings and you and other people have measured.
Yes, absolutely. It adds to the segregation. It is one of the reasons why we have we are the worst city in the country for African Americans and Latinos living in concentrated poverty, and 5th in the country for whites living in concentrated poverty. We want to work to change that. We want to develop things like mixed income housing where people can, you know, housing has more a range of people living with different incomes within the same area. And there's some successful, really successful models of this across the country. And we need to, you know, not only work to educate people in the community about, you know, these issues that bubble up with the NIMBYism, but we also need to change policy processes at the state and county level to help encourage this. So, for example, the County Industrial Development Agency sometimes gives tax abatements for apartments. Often those are luxury apartments. And we want to see things like affordable housing set-asides, maybe, you know, 15 or 20% of the units. If you're receiving a public subsidy, then they should be made to be affordable. New York State, I think, needs to do more to fund these types of mixed-income properties. And I want to say when we talk about subsidized housing, it's important to note that we have actually a really large subsidized housing throughout our community in the form of the mortgage interest deduction that homeowners get. As a country, we actually spend significantly more on things like the mortgage interest deduction for middle-class homeowners than we do on affordable housing for low-income renters. So when we talk about subsidized housing, I think it's important what we're saying because, you know, even I, as a homeowner, I live in subsidized housing, and most homeowners who have a mortgage or deduct their property taxes also do. So I think it's important to distinguish that, that, you know, low-income renters also need help in having some of those same subsidies that are enjoyed by homeowners as well.
That's a really interesting point, and it gets at the things that are easily visible to most people versus the things that aren't, and that indirect kind of subsidy that you get from the write-off on your taxes, on your mortgage interest.
And we actually spend as a country 4 times more on the mortgage interest deduction than we do on all affordable housing rental programs.
So, yeah, that's an interesting segue to the next question, in that because we've just passed a tax bill that changes some of that equation, at least on the tax part of it, property tax part of it. But I wanted to ask you this. President Trump, as a real estate developer before he became President Trump, has some history with fair housing practices. His company was sued by the Justice Department for discrimination. So do you worry about how the federal government is going to orient itself toward this issue under this administration, either because of that history or for other reasons, and looking at some of the language of in the campaign or in the first year of the presidency?
I am worried a bit about some of the what could happen to fair housing under this administration. We just saw recently that HUD is changing its mission statement to remove anti-discrimination language from its mission statement. But there are actually even more specific things that HUD has done. One of the things they are have done recently is suspended an Obama-era provision rule under the Fair Housing Act that would require communities to do more to proactively address fair housing issues. And it was a huge accomplishment under the Obama administration. And that new rule, it's called Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing, has now been suspended by Secretary Carson. And that's a concern. And there's a number of recent developments really that happened within the last couple of years of the Obama administration that helped strengthen fair housing enforcement that are now we're starting to see being clawed back a little bit. And that's a concern. Also, proposals to reduce funding for things like the Community Development Block Grant Program, which not only provides essential services it's an important source of funding for fair housing organizations, but all the partners that we work with throughout the community that help improving housing options for people and provide other essential services like meals and after-school programs, they're working to try to eliminate that funding. Those are real concerns, and it's something that we continue to try to mobilize around and also, hope that it doesn't get worse as well.
That was Sally Santangelo. Sally, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
I really appreciate you having me.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.